Get ready. It's time to tee it up with Keith Jones.
Coming up on today's show, we welcome back renowned author and writer John Steinbreeder to talk about the Ryder Cup and so much more. So stay tuned to get ready as you tee it up with Keith Jones. Welcome to the show. So glad to be along. This hour, we want to check in with a longtime friend. This guy we met more than two decades ago at Chelsea Piers. I tell that story all the time because I had no idea who the man was sitting next to me. It turned out it was John Steinbreeder, renowned writer and world traveler. And this guy just does everything. I think he goes out to cover stories just so he can lower his handicap or keep it low, so when he competes for his club championship, he can actually win it. But we'll let him tell that story. As we welcome John Steinbreeder back to the show. Stein, I really appreciate you making time. It's always great to have you on the show. You always are a worldly man, and we look forward to catching up this hour.
Thanks, Keith. Always good to be with you, and love chatting golf, especially this time of year. It's getting into football season. I don't want to let go of golf.
Yeah, it's tough. You know, it's a rub. Now, Stein has written over 25 books and almost 20 of them, around 20, are about golf. But the rest, other sports, including football. So this guy supposedly knows a bunch about football and stuff. I, like you, am that kind of guy. I covered the NFL for about 10, 12 years, and it really has come a long way since I first started covering the game in the NFL. And the NFL has Bad Bunny coming on as the halftime artist of the Super Bowl played in Santa Clara in February. Thoughts on that, or do you want to veer right or left?
No, I'll go right into it. I have no idea who the hell Bad Bunny is. And which doesn't surprise me, because at my age of 69, I am so culturally ignorant. I don't know anything that's kind of younger than Sinatra, I guess. But I have no idea who Bad Bunny is, but I'm a little bit, you know, the name makes me a little bit nervous about what could be, you know, happening at the halftime show. But, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, indeed we will. And speaking of Sinatra, the New York Yankees are no longer in the playoff hunt. They got knocked out by the Toronto Blue Jays, and the Blue Jays used some lines from Sinatra's songs to bid the Yankees adieu on social media, and I thought that was I'm not a media guy either. Only by default do we do anything through the show and stuff, but it was a lot of disrespect shown from the Blue Jays to the Yankees when they got knocked out.
Well, you know, I just, as somebody who grew up outside of New York and worked in the city and lived in the city, I just think everybody's simply jealous of New York and its greatness in every possible facet. And so, you know, that's tough on them. What can I say?
Yeah, that's true. And here I thought he was
tough on the Blue Jays. I mean, they can, you know, I know Toronto's a great city, but it's not New York. So that's all I have to say.
Are you throwing the Mets in there too? Because they're not in the playoffs anymore.
You know, I'm a Mets fan, and so I've already been licking my wounds and looking towards the New York Rangers hockey season, and the Giants are going down the tube. So I'm kind of in a mess here from a team rooting for a team standpoint, and so it's not good right now, but I still love New York and Mets fans. We were certain masochists, and we just have to own that and deal with that.
Yeah. So what's the deal? Uncle Steve is throwing a lot of money into the team, which is what all the fans wanted to see. They wanted to see Soto come over and the other players added to the roster, and that happened. But the air came out of the balloon.
I think we were just happy to see the Wilpons disappear. So that was definitely addition by subtraction. And it is amazing that Yeah, now, these things happen to the Mets. They will collapse. They will do stuff like you can't believe. I remember one year one of their pitchers went on the disabled list because he had, like, tuberculosis, and another one got bubonic plague. I mean, who the hell in this day and age gets bubonic plague, for crying out loud? It had to be a Met. So, anyway, we don't expect anything less than the collapse they did this year, and, you know, hopefully they'll be better next year, and Uncle Steve, as we all call him back here, he's got a good guy in David Stearns, who's your president of baseball operations, very bright guy, and between his brain and Cohen's money, I think we should be okay. But it still hurts, and then it hurts when the Yankees go out, and I don't know what I'm going to do for sports for a little while, because I'm a Giants fan too, as I said, and that's not going anywhere good either. So
yeah, that's a good point from that standpoint. The Rangers, of course, lose their opener for the season, and so I'm not rubbing salt in the wound. It's just
they got shut out. I mean, they're terrible. I mean, are you kidding me? Here we go. Oh my God. Anyway, I definitely picked the wrong month to quit drinking, that is for sure.
And the Knicks, they thought they were going to get the Bucks star, and that hasn't come to fruition either. So the NBA in itself is a hot mess.
Well, I guess it could be worse. I could be Don Ray, the PGA of America. So, you know, things are still looking up in my world as far as I'm concerned.
And there he goes. Okay, so let's turn now to the Ryder Cup. Also happened in New York. Bethpage Black. What a hot mess that was. And the Americans almost came back miraculously to take the cup, which is insane on the final day of play. But the way the crowds around there acted, and the PGA of America should not be surprised, and the PGA Tour involvement should not be surprised, because you're playing in a hostile city, a hostile environment, and it's the U.S. against Europe. And even though most of the European players live in the United States and make their living in the United States, they still were the big bad enemy. But the vocalization from the fans going on obviously went to extremes, especially when in regards to a guy named Rory, as McIlroy took some a lot of verbal abuse and such. And then you have the PGA of America in this situation where, do we apologize? We're sorry for the fans' behavior and such, but nothing was done along the way.
I don't even know where to start with this whole thing somehow. First of all, what did you think was going to happen when you selected Bethpage Black? What was it, 10 years ago? What do you think was going to happen with that place, home field advantage, open the gates at 7, open the bars at 7:10, basically, you couldn't buy a hot dog or get a breakfast sandwich at 8 in the morning, but you could get a beer or you could get a craft cocktail and just, you know, fuel them full of alcohol from dawn to dusk. And, you know, and you got this comedian saying, F you, Rory, at the first tee, you know, she's been hired to lead the – I mean, it's – what do you expect? I mean, pour more and more gas on a fire – and, you know, all of a sudden it became World Wrestling Federation as opposed to to the Ryder Cup. I mean, yeah. And I was out at 02 and, God, I forget what it was, 09 or 06 was the PGA. I remember being out there, and it was pretty chippy out there in those days. And Colin Montgomery and Sergio came in for a lot of abuse. And there were some words uttered there that Americans aren't used to hearing in public like that. So that was interesting. But I would say 95% of the people I spoke with, Keith, who were out there, and I was not out there, but 95% of the people who I spoke to who were out there said it was the worst thing they had ever seen. It was like being in Gillette Stadium for a Patriots game on Monday Night Football. I mean, it was a mess.
Yeah, it is insanity at its best. And, you know, they need to get together with the powers that be at Augusta National, and I'm talking about the PGA of America and the PGA Tour, and discuss how to control the crowd, the patrons or the fans or whatever you do. You know, and I'm, this is really a thing that's bothered me for a long time, and this is this yelling out, get in the hole! on a par four, and you know, stupid things that come out of people's mouths just because they feel like they're, you know, they want to say it. You know, it's like, no.
Yeah, no, it's very simple. I mean, you just, you know, Augusta's the gold standard in a million ways, and one of it is the environment at the tournament, and I've seen people get escorted off the tournament for cheering when a ball, an approach shot gets hit into the bunker. You know, you just can't get away with that crap. And it's absolutely the most pleasant experience, viewing experience you can ever imagine because of that. And I think it's imperative that, and I think the Irish will do this big time because they didn't like being on the receiving end of this, and they will really get a hold of it. But I think, also, you have to be concerned if you're the PGA of America and the European PGA Tour, the DP World Tour people, to the point where players may just say, unless they change the rules of in certain ways, just say, you know what, it's not worth it, guys. I'm not getting paid any money to do this. I'm getting paid a tiny bit of money. I'm going to take the week off, be with my family, and screw it, because I don't need this. I don't need to be yelled at. I don't need my wife abused. I don't need to be abused. You know, I just don't know that it's, you know, if they don't get a handle on this, I mean, at what point do the players just say, it's not worth it?
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, obviously, Shane Lowry was one of the ones that was very, very happy that Europe kept the cup. But, you know, you leave this bad taste in people's mouths, but people also have long memories. And sometimes you don't need, it's only two more years before the Ryder Cup is played in Ireland. And people have a lot of short memories, so you know it could get. But I have to think that while there will be some people in Ireland that will be a little abusive to the American players, overall, Europeans have a better appreciation, in my view, for the game of golf than the Americans do. Americans in general. And, you know, you have these newer generations coming up that lead with disrespect. So, again, you get what you get.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, the Irish do like a drink, too. And you know, as we've noticed from their soccer fans over in that part of the world, that they can get a little worked up occasionally. So, you know, I'm sure there'll be plenty of scrutiny to make sure that doesn't happen. And but yeah, you gotta think they'll be okay. Although they can be kind of tough in some of the Americans, and the Americans don't help themselves. I mean, I root for the Europeans every time for a variety of reasons, and this is another example where it's just kind of it's. I like a lot of the American players individually, but together, you know, they're just it's not a great, you know, it's not the most personable, likable bunch you've ever seen, and so I think they'll take some abuse, but I think the DP World Tour people and the Irish are going to, you know, they're going to be very, very strict, or a lot stricter on this. And I think Rory and Lowry and Luke Donald and whomever is involved in this is going to really, really impress upon them that this nonsense can't happen again.
Yeah, because you don't want to be on the receiving side any time with that kind of going on.
No, and it's no fun for them either. I mean, I do credit Justin Thomas trying to calm down the crowd a few times, you know, because it was obviously getting out of hand when they were playing. I think he and I forget who he was playing with, and they were going against Rory and Fleetwood, I believe it was, and you know, they kept raising up their hands, and JT did it, trying to get the crowd to sort of back off a little bit. So that was nice. It'll be interesting to see how they end up handling this, because boy, it was tough. It was tough out there.
it was unbelievable. What's not tough is our guest this hour. He's a softie, John Steinbrenner, with us, and we'll be talking more about the Ryder Cup after this break when we come back, and also want to talk about so much more this hour. We'll be back.
Hi, this is Annika Sorensen, and you're listening to Tee It Up with Keith Jones.
Hey And we're back with John Steinbreeder, renowned writer. He has written over 25 books. He's going to probably talk about the latest one that he's written because he's always writing something. But he also writes for Global Golf Post. He's a senior writer there. That's something that Jim Nugent started many years ago now. It's crazy because I remember when Nugent first came up with the idea of an online publication, he got poo-pooed, and now almost everybody is doing it. And actually, the newspapers are obnoxious with their the major newspapers are with their online stuff and their videos and everything else that that they're doing. But Stein graduated from Switzerland, university in Switzerland, amazingly enough. So he does know Swiss. He loves Swiss cheese and everything about the Swiss. So and chocolate's in there too. The Belgians make better chocolate than the Swiss, but you know, unless it's Swiss miss, then nothing misses that. But Stein, tongue in cheek on that. It's interesting with this Ryder Cup because and there were no Swiss players, by the way. But the Europeans, from the time that Luke Donald made his final selection to the time that they teed the ball up for the first duo to play, there was a huge difference in the enthusiasm, and the camaraderie, and everything else. You could see it even during the selection of the captain's choices. Those picks, none of them looked happy when they were on video being introduced.
Well, it's weird. I mean, I was just talking with a good mate of mine today, Jack Druga, who Jack was a longtime head golf professional at Shinnecock Hills. And I was talking with somebody else the other day who's from Friars Head. And they said, the Europeans players, they before and after the Ryder Cup, they've been all around Long Island at the great golf courses out there, playing golf with each other, having a great time. I mean, it's just, and I found this out, years ago when I was covering the Hassan II Trophy in Morocco a bunch in the mid to late 90s. And there were a bunch of European Tour players in those days playing it. And, we'd go out to dinner at night with them. There'd be like 20 of them going out to dinner. They were hanging out together. I mean, it's almost cliche. People have talked about this for ages, but you just can't get over it. You can't deny the fact that it's just a different dynamic. And Jack was telling me about, these guys were playing at Sabonic together. They were playing, Friars Head together. They were playing, different groups. Justin Rose was here. Lowry was there. I mean, they were just out having a great time, and they kind of made a trip of it, made a vacation. They're used to traveling, used to being on the road. They're used to these sorts of things, and they love golf and wanted to be around this great, incredible part of the golf world, which is the eastern end of Long Island. And it's just, it's funny how they seem to embrace it. They seem to enjoy it in ways that the Americans just don't, and seem comfortable in it. And, you get down to team play is a great example of it too, where Friday and Saturday, the Europeans, and granted, they made everything they looked at putting wise. I mean, they putted so beautifully both days, put in the foursomes and the four balls. They just kicked the U.S. team's ass again. I mean, it's just unbelievable how they do this time and time again and demonstrate this sort of team spirit and this ability to play as a team, whether it's an entire 12-man team or whether it's just two guys teeing it up in a foursome or a four-ball match. It's extraordinary to watch how they bond with each other and somehow find a way to play so brilliantly together.
Well, the former European Tour, which has now been remade and such, those guys traveled around. It reminded me a lot of the early days of the PGA Tour, where the players would pack into a car and go from one stop to the next. Those guys over in Europe, a lot of those guys did that. That's how they started to develop their friendships and thus their camaraderies and such, and made a huge difference. And now the PGA Tour has changed as well, because they used to be very fan friendly, and you'd have a lot of players that were bigger names, and they would be a little bit more open to the fans. And now it seems like players on the PGA Tour are really shut into themselves. They're very insular.
I mean, that's sort of the idea, the feeling that you get oftentimes, isn't it? And I don't know what to say about it, but they've tried to do these different systems and different things and how you deal with the Ryder Cup on that side. And, you know, I don't know what you do. I know if I were on the DP World Tour side, I'd just bank up the old Brinks truck, back up the Brinks truck there for Luke Donald and say, what do you want? I mean, you know, I'd keep him for another year because I think that continuity makes a huge difference. I think anytime you're running an organization to change leadership every time, it's, you know, and a lot of clubs do this, and heck, the PGA does it, which is a problem with them, with their president. They change presidents every couple of years.
With John Steinbreeder, we'll be back.
The Dalai Lama. If I'm on a first tee, what am I giving the driver? He hauls off and whacks one. Big hitter.
Lama.
Long. Into a 10,000-foot crevice right at the base of this glacier. You know what the Lama says? Gunga Galunga. Gunga, Gunga Galunga.
And we're back and joined by renowned writer John Steinbreeder. And the Ryder Cup was still something to behold.
Luke has found a secret sauce here, and I think, you know, one of his secret weapons is Eduardo Molinari, the stats guru who I wrote a major takeout on for Global Golf Post, and fascinating guy, and through his work with analytics and discerning who's best paired with whom and who they match up against best and what holes should they be teeing off of on the alternate shot, the foursomes, and things like that. I mean, I just think the Europeans are ahead of the curve in a lot of different ways. And it's a matter of giving them confidence. Donald has talked about this a lot, giving them the confidence so they believe fervently when they go out there that they're the best prepared team and that they're the best equipped team to win based on those analytics and Luke's thinking about every little detail.
All right, so give Donald a bunch of credit because of all that stuff. Now, you mentioned Molinari, and Molinari is a solid player in his own right, obviously out of Italy, for those who are unaware, but he was a great addition to that team. He mattered more, in my opinion, to that team than some of the players. Obviously, he was at least equivalent to being one of the players for his fortitude and all the statistical things he brought to the table.
Yeah, I mean, he did this for Marco Simone and 2 years ago in Rome, which the Europeans won, and he played the same role for Luke then, and you know, he's got this business that this golf analytics company Eduardo has gotten that he sort of merged operations a couple of years ago with Arcos. And, but he's been doing this for himself for, you know, 15 years or so. And really around COVID time started working with, tour players and sort of farming out his services. And one of his very first client was, Matt, Fitzpatrick. And they started working together before, Fitzy won the U.S. Open up at, Brookline. And that's blossomed from there. And now Eduardo's working with about 40 different tour players, men and women. Nelly Korda works with them. And he's got their confidence, and he's so good with this. And he comes at it from a tour player. Like you say, he's won 10 times professionally. He won a U.S. amateur. He won at Marion. So he understands what it's like. He's a professional golfer. He understands what these guys are thinking about. He understands how they think. He understands their time constraints. So not only does he have all the numbers, and he went to an engineering school. I mean, he's just a brilliant math guy. And but he also gets them as golfers too. And that combination is invaluable. And he's really good. He's interesting to talk to. But he did a great job for Luke. And I think it was the first call Luke made after he got asked to re-up again and be the Ryder Cup captain for Bethpage Black. I think his first call was to Eduardo and asked him to come back on.
So what is it that he provides to we understand pretty much what he provided to the Ryder Cup team. But what does he provide to individual golfers that work with him?
I mean, it's mostly looking at how you play. I mean, part of it is course management, you know, and explaining to them and helping them track their numbers and say, okay, this is a weakness of yours and you need to, you know, improve this, or this is what you should be hitting here. This is a shot you should be hitting here, because, you know, sometimes you take too many risks. So just lay off of it a little bit and go more for the center of the green. Because, yeah, when you go for the pin all the time, yeah, sometimes it results in a lot of birdies for you. But at the same token, when you miss a little bit, that's, you know, you go bogey. So these numbers say, hey, if you're better off, you go to the middle of the green on these occasions instead of going at those really tough pins, you know, you can have a better scoring average and things like that. So it's course management, you know, it's understanding what club to use. I mean, one of the things with Fitzpatrick was, you know, Fitzy was, you know, short. He wasn't that long. And for some reason, he hit a lot of three woods and off the tee. And Eduardo says, listen, you need to get longer. So he, Fitzpatrick, worked with an instructor and with this distance tool, and I forget the name of it off the top of my head, but worked really hard on that, and he gained a lot of length. And by the time he got to Brookline for that Open that he won, he played the first two rounds with Dustin Johnson, and they were pretty much neck and neck as far as driving distance is concerned. So, you know, to understand this is what I need to work on, that's a big part of it as well. So just little things like that, the course management, understanding your game, where your strengths are, where your weaknesses are, what you need to work on, all those things. And then what flows out of all this, Keith, is confidence. I mean, this is what Donald talked about. This is what Molinari talked a lot about to me. It's making these players give them as much confidence. And every time they stand over that ball, and you know how competitive it is at that level and how, you know, how small a margin of error there is for that. And to have that confidence and to know this is exactly the right club to hit this shot, it makes all the difference in the world. It really helps. And I think that's what he's trying to do with the individual player.
Well, Stein, I have seen that with Fitzpatrick firsthand. There's no question his confidence as a player and Streck and these other guys that were a kind of not as well known as some of Lowry and some of these other guys that contributed to the win for Europe. But the confidence part that you mentioned is something definitely have seen in Fitzpatrick. But you would think that these golfers, as high level as they are, would be able to do that themselves. I mean, I watch Tiger all the time, and the best golf coach for Tiger was Tiger. He could fix almost anything. So these guys have that prowess, but why they just that's not a something that they think about when they're doing it?
I don't know. It's weird, though, when you think about it. I mean, Nicklaus used to always talk about, you know, Jack Grout was great with him because one of the things he taught Jack was how to fix himself on the golf course. So, you know, you never saw Jack used to, you know, laugh about, you know, you never saw Jack Grout with Jack out on the range. I mean, you know, Grout would be walking with Nicklaus. He'd be outside the ropes and, you know, he would just be spectating and watching. But he had taught Jack the importance of fixing yourself, and Jack was very good at that. Yeah, and you look at Tiger, and Tiger was great and all that, and so much of that is natural ability, and he knew his game really well, and he could do practically anything. But at the same token, you know, Tiger did a lot of kind of crazy stuff. Like, you know, he started to, you know, try to hit the ball as far as he could all the time instead of, you know, keeping up with the Joneses in that regard, as opposed to just, you know, not worrying about the fact he wasn't the only one being able to hit all the Augusta par fives and two anymore, and not getting away from the other things in his game that he did so bloody well. And I think sometimes, you know, it's just great to have that other voice that can help you and help you understand and statistically prove it to you. And I've seen this. I talked to Scotty Cameron about this. What separated him is in putters is he had the data. He provided the data so he could tell a Brad Faxon or an Ernie Els or a Tiger Woods, you know, the data proves out what I'm saying. And I think that's the thing about Molinari. It just is that reassurance that this just isn't somebody, you know, whistling in the wind there. This is proven information and proven data. I would agree with you, though. Tiger was different. Jack was different. I mean, their level of confidence, of excellence was so great that they were able to sort a lot of that out themselves. But I think Tiger certainly could have used a lot of assistance sometimes with these analytics. And he got a lot of good information from Butch Harmon, obviously, because, you know, just by ourselves under our own islands, it's hard not to, you can do better with a little feedback.
Yeah, there's no question, Stein. You got to be open to the receptiveness of getting that information, because a lot of these guys, you know, know best in their minds, and that's just how that is. I've often called Tiger the best second shot player I've ever seen, because when his driver went wonky, he had to come out of some rough, and he usually was miraculous with that second shot. But that certainly makes a lot of sense what Molinari is doing, and I'm sure he's not the first, but it is a huge respect factor when you're talking about from one professional athlete to another. A lot of the talk about this on the show pretty regularly, because there are a lot of good golf coaches out there or golf instructors, but a number, including of some of the name guys, never played competitively. So they don't have that to bring to the table. And that's one of the things that separates those who have from those who haven't.
Exactly. 100%.
So when you were working with Michael Breed on his book, and I didn't realize it until I was looking at this long list of books that you had written or co-written, because Breed has been this rising star for a number of years, and he has a huge online presence and such. What was that like? Because I've had Breed on the show, and I know him fairly well, but he's a character. So was it an easy write with him, or was it more challenging?
Well, no, it was very easy in that he's a very good communicator. It kind of reminded me of one of my books was Hockey for Dummies, and I worked with a guy named John Davidson, who was a great goalie for the Rangers and later a terrific commentator before he got into management and ran a few golf teams and did so quite well in the St. Louis Blues and the Columbus, is it the Blue Jackets, I guess it
correct,
is?
Correct, Blue Jackets. Ding, ding.
But he was, so Michael communicates very well verbally, so that made it pretty easy, and a lot like working with JD. His mind is active, so it was, I guess, the most difficult part, if difficult is the right word, is just keeping him focused and keeping him from going too deep off into tangents, because he's just such a student of the game. He's got a lot of ideas. He's always trying to come up with different ways, different ways to look at something, different ways to approach a problem or a situation. But no, it was great. It was absolutely terrific working with him and what he, you know, what he believed in, what he did, I believed in, and it was fun to work with.
So who improved your putting game more, Michael Breed or Scotty Cameron?
Well, Scotty didn't. Scotty talked to me mostly about the technology of the putter, which is a little bit easier to deal with. Michael, it took me about 2 years after we did the book for me to get my putting back, and that wasn't Michael's fault. That was just I had so much putting information crammed into my head. I'm just not mentally strong enough to filter it all out. But no, Michael's thing was very simple. You know, we called it the 3-degree putting solution, and it was using the forward press, really, and trying to get that three degree of loft in your putter, so you know the ball would roll right off the bat and not pop up in the air, and in this way you could enhance your distance control and your direction a lot. So the theory was great. We just, again, you know, we talked so much about it and had gone through so much stuff going back to Bobby Locke and Horton Smith, and you know, he just, I mean, the information I gathered and he gathered, because he was constantly looking at ways to figure stuff out, it was a little overwhelming at times mentally for me. I'd stand over a putt and my mind would start to short circuit, and I was like, oh geez. But that was more on me than Michael, that's for sure.
I don't know about that, Stein. We were with John Steinbrenner, renowned author and writer and world traveler and all kinds of stuff. You've done some phenomenal things in your life, and getting to work with John Davidson, I know, was a real treat for you, because being a Ranger fan, and he actually was much more impactful in net than I think sometimes he gets credit for, but did do a nice job commentating and such.
Well, yeah, I mean, he was the John Madden of hockey. I mean, he was the best color commentator the sports ever had, in my view. And when I was doing the book, one of the real treats was is during the Rangers Devils semifinal Stanley Cup playoffs one year. I sat in the booth with between he and Sam Rosen, and I had the headphones on and sat with them during an entire game, being able to hear what the producer was saying to them both. And I mean, talk about developing respect. I mean, I've done a fair amount of TV, and I feel very comfortable in front of the camera as I feel comfortable talking to you on the radio. But to cover a game that's that fast with so many players, with names from all over the world that need to be pronounced in a variety of different ways, and things moving the way they were with line changes and everything else, I can't believe how well they do and how well they kept it all together and how well they kept viewers informed. I mean, talk about talent. I was so in awe of that experience. It was great for me. It really helped in, you know, the writing of parts of the book. But, man, were those guys good at what they did.
Well, I tell you, that thing in your ear or their ear was called an IFB, and it is – I don't want to call it annoying, but it definitely, the first few times you use it, you're like, wait, am I talking to myself? Wait, what is that a word from God? I'm not sure who's in my ear right now. So it can throw you off, and you're supposed to keep talking and, you know, make it fluid and not, you know, you hear what they're saying, but you try not to encompass that into what you're saying, which is an art form that gets developed, let me tell you. So.
No, they were great. They were great, and JD was the best. And we actually played a fair amount of golf together. He and Brian Gumbel were big buddies. They were members of Whippoorwill. They had lockers right next to each other, and they'd get a bunch of the Rangers, ex-Rangers, current Rangers together. They'd have these big sort of scrambles up at Whippoorwill that during the week, and I played in a few of those. And those guys all love their hockey, that's for sure.
Yeah, you've played with a lot of who have been your favorite. I know it's hard for you because you've been playing around so many professional athletes over the years, golf and otherwise, but who have been your favorite golf buddies to play with from an athlete standpoint?
Oh man, well, you know, JD would be up there from just a non PGA professional standpoint. I mean, he was such great company in the golf course and the good time. I mean, that's kind of a hard one. Brad Faxon was a lot of fun playing with him. I went quail hunting with Davis Love and quail hunting with Nick Price, and that was that was as good as being out in the golf course with him, if not better. Actually, I liked it better because I was about as good a shot as they both were, so there wasn't that big a difference in ability, which was kind of fun.
Nice.
No, I mean, it's been great to play with a lot of these guys. And, you know, I've had fun playing in some amateur events over the years and playing with some really good players in the amateur game. And, you know, I just love to compete. I love to be out there. And I love guys that just are there for the same reasons I am, which is just to have a good time and to enjoy it. Sure, you want to win. Sure, you want to do well. But you know, to be with people that love the game as much as so many of these guys do, and that appreciate it so much—that's the best. I don't care what sport they're from, but everybody seems to gravitate to golf, seems to really enjoy it when they get out there.
No question. It's one of the reasons I do this show. John Steinbrenner will stay with us for another segment on Teed Up with Keith Jones. We're happy to have him. We're happy that you're along with us, and we will be back after this break. And we're back to wrap up the show with John Steinbrenner, a longtime friend, a great writer, a great radio guy. You hear that, you know, and a good name dropper every once in a while. I was fortunate a number of years ago to be at Sea Island and have dinner with Davis. Love the third. And fascinating guy. A lot of these guys, that's what we love about this show and also about talking to different people around the game of golf. They have this other side that people never see or never hear about, and that's always fascinating because the golfer, professional golfers, that's their job. What do they do when they're not doing their job? That's the interesting part.
Yeah, and it's fun, you know, just to be around them in that regard. And I think this is one of the things we've lost in this business. When I say the business of journalism, is I think it's much harder. And my friends were complaining about this with the Ryder Cup, for example, that the PGA did not make any of the U.S. Ryder Cup team members available for the media on Friday and Saturday. There's a much greater gulf and distance than there used to be in terms of media being around the athletes themselves. And that's too bad, because I've had a lot of fun with people like Nick Price or Davis or Brad Faxon or Webb Simpson or, Constantino Rocca or Patrick Harrington. I mean, all these guys over in Europe, especially when we'd all go out to dinner together, and they weren't ever worried about anybody writing about stuff that was going on at 11 at night when we were at some restaurant in Marrakesh. They weren't, worried about saying something when they'd had a little bit too much to drink. I mean, it was just, there were times that you were on the record. There are times that you weren't. And, you know, you developed trust and relationships and they would open up with you, and you got to know them. And now it's just harder and harder to get to know any of these guys, because they're, I think, terrified to do so. I don't think their agents or managers want them to spend any time, as little time as possible, with members of the news media. And in some ways, you can't blame them, given all the Twitter stuff, or I guess the X stuff, all the social media. Yeah. It's just a different world, which is too bad, because a lot of these guys are so much fun to be around. And I mean, and you've done it too. We've all seen it. But whether you're with Gary Player or Arnold in the old days, or Jack, I mean, the conversations you have with these guys, I mean, you know, I remember having like a 2-hour lunch with Jack one time at Scioto, his old hometown club. And I mean, the stuff he was telling me about, I was absolutely cracking up, and I was wearing out my pen taking notes so quickly, because it was so good. And that's the stuff I love, and that's the stuff I miss, because you just don't quite, you just don't get that opportunity as much as you used to, because I think, you know, people shy away from it, frankly.
Yes, media is killing our society, but also our industry has changed some. And I don't mean golf media per se, although that's changed a lot as well. But the media in general is—it's a bad word, and it's unfortunate. And it's one of the reasons you reminded me why I love having you on the show, because we can talk about that kind of stuff, and I in my mind relive it as you're talking about it, because I've had some great relationship with some great players in different sports over the years, and it really makes a difference. I feel very much more enriched, you know, and they knew where I was coming from. That's how you build a rapport. You build a rapport by having a conversation, and then there's a trust that's built, and then those guys. I think back to Shirley Povich and all these guys that used to be these beat writers in Red and such, and they had these relationships and made a huge difference. I mean, Rice wouldn't be the writer he was if he didn't have those relationships, and it's just, it's missing, and it's sad and such. And I'm not going to bring us down towards the end of this show, but I just want to say I appreciate you. You're being on, you old guy. You'll always be older than me, so I appreciate that and stuff. But
I haven't gotten you with any trouble with the FCC in a few years, so we're doing okay,
yeah,
right?
You only said ass a few times.
You're off probation now.
Yeah, well, you only said ASS a few times, so that's okay. So that's a sense. That's short for association for those playing along at home. But I know you'll be traveling again soon. Apparently, Morocco called, and they want to make sure that your visa has cleared.
Oh, yeah. I think I'm an honorary citizen over there, which is great fun. I'm only kidding, of course, when I say that. So, yeah, I'm going over there in end of October, one of the great places on the planet as far as I'm concerned. Great golf destination. I've been over there. This will be my 15th time to Morocco over the years, and I just can't spend enough time there. It's just a spectacular place, terrific courses, wonderful culture, really, really cool, interesting, good people, and just a blast to be around. It just is great, great fun. And so I'll be there for about 10 days running a tournament. I run a pro-am tournament, which is with a couple of colleagues, which is good fun.
He is still a busy, busy boy. John Steinbreeder, my guest on TW Keith Jones. Get out there. We're just out of time. Get out there and practice your game. Stein would do it. Practice. Take your game to the next level, and we will talk to you next week. Take care.